I'm going to now invite Dr. Barbara Bass, who is our immediate past president of the American College of Surgeons, and Dr. Herb Chen, who is the professor of surgery and chair at the University of Alabama, to come join our panel. And we will be happy to take questions from the audience as well. So I want to just start off by kind of looking out there to you guys just a little bit. And the first question is kind of, we talked a lot about changing the environment rather than changing the people. And I love that idea, and I love that as a future goal for all of us to work on. But when we look around the environment here, we see a lot more women than we do men. And the number of chairs and people who really have the capacity to make those types of changes is somewhat limited. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to turn to the panel here and say, how do we now work on changing the environment if we're not even getting them to listen to the message?
I'll talk about that. I mean, I think over and over again, I heard this is a job of leadership. I mean, this is not about the young people coming along that are doing their best to develop skills, to be noticed, to be developed, to learn to negotiate, all this kind of nonsense. I really think this is totally about putting this opportunity on the people that have the power to change it. And that is actually in our system. For the most part, if you're a surgeon in academic surgery, that is your chair or your division leader. And I think we just have to really, I think that's the group we need to target, not the young people. We need to target the senior people. And I think I credit Herb for his incredible efforts at UAB for being intentional about looking at the salary disparities. I think this project that the American Surgical just went through, which actually was born out of, as you may recall, a breakfast meeting of the women surgeons. That's where sort of the clarion call came for that. And Keith Lillimo, who happens to have a daughter who's a surgeon, by the way, all of a sudden, I think it's one of the things we see is that when you have a diverse, i.e. a woman or somebody else like that, come along in your family who's now trying to walk your gauntlet, all of a sudden, that's an eye-opener. Ooh, it's not quite the same for her. And then, of course, Ron, having been the incoming president, took it up and organized a group of very, very engaged, impassioned leaders in surgery to put together this document. It was done in a very methodical way. The target audience for that document is leadership. I mean, we want you all to read it, all the young people to read it, but the target audience for that is the people who have the opportunity to make that change, and those are chairs, division head, deans, whatever it happens to be in our domain. So I think it's really, we need to be very clear about who's really responsible for this. And yes, it sort of reflects then a systems change, but you can't change something if you're not empowered. You can do all you want, but you just can't change it. You can fuss, you can plead, you can. But the fact is, we got to hold our leaders accountable. And I think that's the beauty of this American Surgical document. It really is targeted on that. And I think we have organizations, our Society of Surgical Chairs, and even just networking among the chair leaders. There's been a lot more calls back and forth. Okay, how are you doing compensation? How do you handle interviews? How do you do these things? But I think it's really important that this is leadership's problem. I really believe that.
You know, I think it's really scary to come into a room that's tackling a problem like this as part of the majority. And I think one of the things that is great about this is that if you listen to us talk about it, this isn't about a male problem, this isn't about a leader problem, this is about a society problem. And so the hope is that by keeping it non-confrontational and by having everybody having ownership of it, it can hopefully become less scary for people who are in the majority to join in on the initiative. The one thing that I didn't talk much about was that idea of the male champions of change, which I don't think is in America yet, but when I was visiting Australia and New Zealand, I had the opportunity to meet with somebody who was the healthcare representative. And this is an incredibly powerful group of men who have been organized by women to join in the fight. They were given an invitation. And these people became so impassioned about it. And I really think that, and again, I get accused of being an optimist all the time, but I think that the reason that leaders aren't necessarily giving this the attention that they need is, number one, it's scary. Number two, they don't really understand the scope of the problem and the implications that it has. And so we need to sort of educate people. But number three is that I think this is an opportunity for younger people to invite more experienced leaders into the conversation individually.
So I was just gonna, I appreciate everyone mentioning our study, but I wanna be transparent about actually what we, how we approached it. And so what we did is we didn't really have what I felt was a very transparent compensation plan. So we didn't go at it knowing we had a disparity. We went at it to create a compensation plan that we deployed, to be fair, and then we went back to look at the data, and we found is that after we deployed the compensation plan, we didn't know what the baseline was. So when we saw what the baseline was, we were like really shocked, because I thought they were fair, perhaps, just looking at things, so we just wanted to make it transparent. But what we found is there was a huge inequity in pay that within a year we could make some progress on. But the point is that we would have never looked had we not done this new plan. And so I think one is to, you don't know what exists until you look. And two, I think that the point, why I wanted to say this is that, so we had no end, we didn't make the plan to try to create or fix something that we thought was wrong. We just created a plan that was fair. And so I think sometimes when you create things that are fair, that can help you battle some inequities.
Could I just add one comment about the Royal Australasian effort? It was actually, you know, it was born of a series of blatant sexual harassment, really unfathomable, good old-fashioned, explicit bias harassment in a very sexualized fashion that finally kind of got the attention of leadership. And there is now, that there was an apology to women trainees, women surgical trainees in the country. There's mandatory training for everyone now that is involved in residency training and how to deal with your own implicit bias, and certainly stringent training and boundaries on sexual predation, bullying, harassment, et cetera. So it's got a sort of a dark history, but I think those that have embraced it have really carried it forward in a really positive and meaningful way.
From the audience, please.
Hi. Not working? Okay. Hi, I'm Megan Gu. I'm a general surgery resident. Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Hi, I'm Megan Gu. I'm a general surgery resident at Baylor in Houston. Thank you so much for everything that you spoke about. It was I pretty much took a picture of like every slide. I have several questions. I have three questions, actually. So one question is for Dr. Chen. Just as a resident, I don't really know how much I can do with this, but is the information for target salaries, is that public data? And then collecting things like mean RVUs and actual people's salaries, is that public data? And then for Dr. Greenberg, Dr. Ren, and Ms. Chalavi, in your talk, Ms. Chalavi, you mentioned that blinding can be a helpful process in removing the implicit biases. But at the same time, Dr. Greenberg and Dr. Ren, you know, you pointed out that being consciously, you know, trying to select candidates that add diversity, how do you reconcile that those things? And then Dr. Bass, you really inspire me. I thank you for mentioning the story about AWS. That I just love that history. I love telling that story to medical students and other residents. But just the American College of Surgeons started in 1913, and then there was a breakfast that Dr. Newman started in 81, and now we tripled, like by magnitudes, the attendance to AWS, and that's really, really amazing. In 2014, we had 4 women chairs of the Department of Surgery, and now I think we're up to, is it 21?
22,
yeah. What do you think changed from 2014 to now? You know, it's only 4 years to make that change, and what sort of things do we need to kind of keep doing to keep that rolling? That's a lot of questions, and there's other people, so.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll take since mine was first. So, yes, you can get that information. Typically, I see some of our chief residents and residents there in the corner. So when I meet with our chief residents every month, and at one of our lunch sessions, we cover how do you find the benchmark salaries, either through AAMC, which we use AAMC for the South, or MGMA. And so I give them the tables so they have them, so they're armed with information when they go search for jobs.
I think in terms of the blinding issue, and this also I think gets at the structured interview question, is that you really, as you're sifting through your initial applications, I think it's really important that you keep bias out of who is qualified for the job. But any job is going to have multiple people that are qualified. And so it's as you get beyond that, where you have everyone who's qualified, that you start thinking about diversity. And I really liked, I think it was Sherry's recommendation about, rather than ranking people, as you get to your conversation about who's going to get the job, focusing on the strengths and the areas for improvement or the weaknesses that each candidate has, so that you can see how those align with the objective things that you laid out before you even read the first CV about what this job needs.
So we've done at the residency level some blinded and unblinded interviews. So we split our faculty, half have seen a portfolio, half hadn't, have not. And that's been very interesting to see, because, you know, you read a portfolio and it's like, oh, you went to this school and that school, and you know, you see these things begin to happen. At the faculty level, it's been, we've debated, when I've run a bunch of searches, I've actually debated sterilizing CVs. The biggest problem is when you're hiring people into academics, you're looking at their papers, and almost by, at some point in time, somebody knows exactly who these people are. So taking out, you know, it became an undoable thing to actually take the CVs and clean them enough and have enough data in them to sort of be able to judge them. So getting to, you know, the equivalent of the, it wasn't just the curtain in the orchestra, they also had to have them take their shoes off because women's shoes sound different than men's. We are not there yet, but I think some of these things, I just went to a search committee where we literally spent the time first talking about what is the job. And when I then went and read the 40 applicants to the job, it became really easy. It's like, oh my gosh, this person has no qualifications. I didn't even care what gender. And the bottom line is, with a lot of people's names these days, I have no idea what gender they are, which is also nice. But I'd be happy to go to initials.
If I just add a couple of comments. Your questions are superb, by the way. I congratulate you on hitting on the very difficult points. But since they've been talking about dinosaurs all morning, I thought I'd comment as one. And, you know, nobody likes change just because it's change. Everybody likes to be in their comfort zone and the traditions that have worked for them their whole careers. And so I think to make things change, you basically have to deal with it as a direct issue of change. And the data is available that shows that these changes are the correct thing to do. And you can ignore data, which some people do, and you're probably not going to change them. But if anybody who looks at the information with an open mind, they have to recognize the benefits of this change in policies, approaches, and openness. I don't want to pat my institution too much on the back, but the more I learn about, like most things in life, the variability around the country is unbelievable on these issues. My department had the leadership from the last 25 years of being unbelievably dedicated to equity and openness that most institutions, as I'm finding out, really didn't have. And so I've had that background for two decades now, supporting most of these principles, and we've applied most of them. You know, 35%, when I started my fellowship, I was in the first 10 years able to have 35% of my trauma fellows were females. And the national average was 3% of trauma surgeons are females. But it didn't stand out because in our institution, fortunately for me, because it wasn't my great idea, but we recognize diversity is a good thing. And you have to actively create the environment so you have diversity. And that's what it comes down to. The other thing for people like me with my bad habits is I have to recognize my implicit biases are unbelievable. And it's how easy it is for me to slip back into my implicit biases. And fortunately, I have good friends like Patty Newman and Sherry Wren and Barbara Bass who have no problem reminding me constantly of my slipping back into my bad habits. But it's non-confrontational, they're friends, and it really is, I think, the way that has a major impact is that you have to have relationships and the ability to constantly bring up the issues, non-confrontational, but just say, you know you're doing this, you know the department's doing this, this is not the correct way to move forward and optimize our department, our division. And so hopefully, I think what we've come over the hump with is there are more and more people in leadership, and once you get to a certain level, then it starts to really grow rapidly, and that's why it's up to 22 chairs are now.
I'll also say that I really respect when a leader actually acknowledges the fact that they were caught doing something that was, you know, I'm so sorry, Barbara, I called you Barbara rather than Dr. Bass, or does any, even in bigger ways, I think that that's a sign of leadership, and the correction publicly is actually a sign of growth, and I think that's what we all need to do. Sorry.
I just want to say very briefly to tell the story about why we now have 22 women chairs, and I can tell you that was intentional effort by the very small group of women chairs that existed back then. We were a group of four or five. We started having a breakfast meeting of just the surgical women chairs. We made a nice, just as the old Worthy Woman campaign of Kathy Anderson, Patty Newman, and Olga Jonasson that helped me 20, 30 years ago. And we knew of every single chair search that was going on. And we also had a list of about 20 to 30. Some have taken the bait and some have not taken the bait. We have a few on the stage we'd still like to see move on a little bit. But I think that we really intentionally gathered people, we networked, we helped them prep, we recommended them, and served as references from the search committees when they called. This was an intentional effort, and boy, has it paid off. And we actually have an abstract that's going to be presented to the AAMC this coming November that Mary Kalacki, who's the chair at Tulane, and Ann Mosenthal, who's the chair at UMD&J, I can't remember who the third author was. But anyway, but as a group, we've really intentionally, so it takes intentional work. It can't just be, oh, there's more of them out there. You know, they're going to bubble up in their own national way. You got to have active, intentional effort. And in fact, even though we have 21 or 22 now, that still represents only about 8% of chair jobs. So we still have a long way to go.
Take another question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Pat Bailey. I'm from Philadelphia, and I applaud all of what you've said. I'm a bit of a dinosaur, and I trained in the early 80s, and when I went looking for a job, there weren't a lot of offers. Even though I must say I trained at a major university in Philadelphia, that I always felt equal. I think there's a lot of observations here. As a trainee, I never felt prejudiced against, although there were times when I was told that I was competing against the other woman resident for a spot. But my question is, could you address, so I went into academics, I was in an academic institution for several years, and then I went into the community. When I left academics, I was actually given a letter from the dean saying, we recognize that you are underpaid. I mean, I actually was given a letter that said that. And we recognize it's probably because you're a woman. And thankfully, I don't think any of those letters are getting written anymore. But when I went into private practice, I went into the community, this is a comment I'd like to make, pay parity is a lot more difficult to create because you're being paid, and I think that's a comment for the trainees, is that, you know, when you're in an academic institution, it's a lot easier to hide these things, but when you're in private practice, you know, we have that expression, you eat what you kill. I mean, so it's a lot more difficult to have disparity in the private practice. However, I'd like to ask you to comment on the fact that I think there's a perception by younger trainees and people looking for jobs that those kinds of situations are not as supportive of women. And I've had difficulty hiring people to come into my type of a practice. They feel that they're going to get more support in these bigger institutions. And could you comment on that?
Okay. Well, I think it's, are you in solo practice now or no?
Well, I was in a, I'm actually not in practice anymore, but I was in a private practice and then a community-based practice where we were employed.
I think it's a sort of a complicated question to answer these days, and the changing way in which the surgical workforce is being recruited and employed and self-employed and all these kind of things. But I do think this may get somewhat to Caprice's, Dr. Greenberg's Caprice. I'm going to call you Caprice because then we're friends here, right? We're friends here. Okay. But in terms of the kind of the like attracts like phenomena that Sherry talked about, the notion of women in many respects often being segregated in the lower compensated areas of surgical disciplines. It's kind of still out there, no question about it. That's happening. And I think that there is still, I mean, I think the greatest implicit bias I see absolutely is the fact still that, believe it or not, we are the ones that have the babies. And that is forever on the front burner of anyone who hires a young woman into a practice. I mean, what are we going to do? She's going to have a baby. She's going to quit. I can tell you, when I had my first son, when I was a resident, I had my program assumed I would never come back to work. You know, that was the end of me. But of course, and obviously we have many, many people now who have managed to have children and continue their careers as well. But that particular grain of implicit bias relative to women that remain in a disparate, significantly disparate proportion of the profession is a really tough one to crack. And so they assume you're going to work less hard. We can pay you less because your husband makes more money. There's all these bazillions of things which really do, I think, limit women's opportunities to join a practice. And maybe joining another woman, they would think, well, this is even going to be a double whammy. You know, we better get someplace else. So it's hard to answer your question precisely, but I do think that the number of things that are often considered implicit bias actually are overt bias when it comes to the hiring of younger women into high demand, gender imbalanced professions.
Well, we're going to take this last question from the audience because we're going to go over time. Sorry, hopefully the panel maybe stick around for just a little bit. Go ahead.
Stephanie Lumpkin from the University of North Carolina. When I was in med school, I was told I was too bossy to go into OB-GYN. Lo and behold, I ended up in surgery, which were definitely my people. And I was at dinner last night, and I was told women surgeons are expected to be one of three things: lazy, the B word, or a mom. And that's the prototype that gets pushed forward. This was another mom that felt like she was being, this was a mom surgeon who felt like she kind of felt those discriminations in her day-to-day life in surgery. And the fact that one woman can't represent all women, what's the next step? Getting not just women in leadership, but women of color, women of different socioeconomic means, women who represent different family structures, what's next?
I'd say that could also be successful as well described here in our panel, so.
All of those things. That's the problem with having just one, is that person becomes a token, and we somehow expect them to represent all women or all African Americans or all anything, whereas all of us who live in the world know that there's an endless diversity within all of those categories of diversity as well. So it has to be all. And connecting that point to what Barbara was saying earlier, I wanted to just Go back to this idea of seeing as believing and role models, because one of the ways to start changing these perceptions over time is to be more visible about our choices and to have more visible examples of mothers, of fathers who come back to surgery, right, or come back to work and are very open about the fact that they had a baby and I was gone for however many months, but look, I'm back. And I think in the past there have always been people who have come back, but they haven't been very open about that because, if anything, they've tried to downplay the fact that they were gone for any length of time. So again, the power of role models.
So I also think that we don't necessarily talk about our paths in front of younger people enough. So every year I address our first generation underrepresented minority. We have a whole group of students who come to Stanford from different high schools, community colleges, all sorts of things. And when they look at me and you get introduced as a professor and a vice chair and I'm wearing a suit that I never could have afforded, you know, I got my first job at age 14, and I talk about basically growing up on the south side of Chicago, nobody looks at me and thinks about this, that my dad was a TV repairman, and I have three brothers who are not college educated. I mean, the funny thing is, at Dr. Meyer's institution, one of his female surgeons ran into my brother.
It's Mayer.
Mayer, sorry. There we go, Mayer. That's why I call him Ron, because I can't say his name. Ran into my brother. So my brother is the guy who fixes everything at Harborview Medical Center. And he's the guy when the
He's a good guy,
yeah. When the HVAC goes out, my brother comes and fixes it, right?
Yeah.
And so my brother and I look a lot alike, except he has a beard. We have the same last name. And one of his partners ran into my brother, and they are going through the where do you know somebody from thing, because it's clear. And he finally says to her, you know, my sister is a surgeon, and that did it. What I have found is that by getting up, especially at the youngest of ages, high school, where they can't imagine, I look, you know, like some old, white, rich woman at this point in time, I hope. And they can't imagine that, you know, I started literally on the south side and nobody in my family is a college grad. So I think we need to talk about, there's so much diversity in all of us sometimes, and we just don't talk about it enough.
I want to say one more thing, and that is that when we start talking about equity, I actually feel sort of, I feel sorry for the people that are having to deal with sort of equity coming at them from the other way. In other words, the privileged group that have long expected, hey, they've worked hard, they've done the job, they're here. And I think the line that I think it was one of my residents said to me was that, you know, and I wish I could find the real primary quote, it's when you're accustomed to privilege, equity feels like a harm. You know, so if you forever sort of had an advantage every step along the way, all of a sudden, if you say, well, we're going to actually let everybody kind of have an opportunity that is based on performance, on skill set, on what, regardless of what you look like, oof, that kind of hurts. And so I think we have to have an understanding of the kind of pushback that we see from those people that are actually accommodating this new position of equity, of opportunity and advancement and everything else. So we need to recognize the landscape we're working in. I think we have to be very open in our discussions. We have to try and be as empathic to that group as we would expect them to be towards us, knowing that that's kind of hard for some people. And we have to kind of keep at it because of that.
I think this is an incredibly subtle point that you bring up, because, you know, what do you hear now when you hear about chairs? You hear, oh, you know, a white man can't get a chair job in this country, right? And so I was talking recently to one of the other female chairs who has a list of all the white men who've become chairs since we've had this increase in the number of women, right? And, you know, they are still getting chair jobs. They are still getting all these opportunities. And it's really important that as we're highlighting diversity, that we continue to celebrate and highlight the majority's successes as well, to show that you can still succeed. It's just that everybody now has those opportunities.
I'd like to thank the panel and all of you for your attention. Thank you so much.